It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know whoever said news slows down in the summertime, but boy, were they wrong today. On this Wednesday at the end of July, we had a 300-point market swing over credit worries. Another automaker reporting it made money. And oh yeah, the Wall Street Journal is going to be sold. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this last day of July. The last half hour of trading is what did it, really. At one point today, the Dow was up 140 points. Investors gave all that back, plus another 150 to close down about 1.1%. A bad day, to be sure, but nothing we'd start off with in most normal circumstances. Have a look at the last week or so, though, and it's clear something's bugging this market. A stock we told you about yesterday was the symptom today, American Home Mortgages. The troubled lender said it's run out of cash, its lenders won't give it any more money, and that bankruptcy's an option. AHM shares dropped right out of sight, down about 90% as Wall Street's worries over the credit crunch continue. General Motors surprised investors today. The carmaker turned in a $900 million profit, its third positive quarter in a row. No thanks to American consumers, GM lost another $39 million here at home. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports now on who's buying those GM cars.
American cars may not be selling at home, but foreigners are snapping them up. In Europe, GM upped its profits by 65%, the best it's done across the pond since 1996. GM also posted records in Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East. You won't see most of these cars in American showrooms. Michael Robinette at CSM Worldwide says GM customizes its cars for local tastes.
A Celta down in Brazil is a vehicle we don't see on the roads a lot in North America. It's what we call a B-segment vehicle in the business. It's very much a mini vehicle.
In China, GM switched from European designs to Korean ones. Some Chinese like their cars American style. Tim Dunn of J.D. Power & Associates says GM's big Buicks are popular with the new rich.
They like big things, big vehicles. Senior management type people, company fleets. People who might be driven around.
But even with all these overseas sales, analysts don't think Motown has gotten its groove back. Bruce Clark covers GM for Moody's Investor Service. He says GM has to settle with its unions, cut costs, and sell more cars at home.
It's going to be critical for them to continue to hold on to market share in North America and to do that without relying on excessive incentives. And they've got to convince consumers to begin paying up.
He's not optimistic GM can switch gears. Moody's is keeping its GM rating at the low end of the junk market. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
Here's another update to a story from yesterday. The Federal Communications Commission published its rules for the next wireless spectrum auction today. They go about halfway to something called full open access. Telecommunications companies will still be able to control who gets to use the bandwidth they buy. Ethics reform has come to Washington. Again, the House passed a sweeping reform bill earlier today by a vote of 411-8. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Many good government groups are hailing the House-passed ethics bill as a major breakthrough. Meredith McGeehee is at the Campaign Legal Center.
The three most important words associated with this bill are sortable, searchable, and downloadable.
Lobbyists will have to disclose their contributions to charities with ties to members of Congress. And if they collect bundles of campaign contributions worth $15,000 or more, they'll have to disclose that, too. And instead of filing these paper reports in the basement of the U.S. Capitol, all these records will be posted online.
Information that has essentially been hidden from the public's eyes and only available to investigative reporters will be viewed by citizens who don't have the luxury of coming to the nation's capital to find it out.
But not everyone's a fan of the bill. A group of conservative senators is calling it a cop-out.
I'm going to try to amend it, and I'm going to try to filibuster it, and I'm going to try to change it.
Senator Tom Colburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, says the bill gutted provisions that would force members to reveal their support for earmarked spending on pet projects. South Carolina's Jim DeMint agrees.
Most of the corruption problems that we've had in Congress can be directed right back to earmarks.
McGeehee admits the bill's not perfect, but
we are in kind of that make it or break it moment. Either this gets sent to Bush or we're in a world of hurt where the reform is going to be significantly weaker.
The Senate's expected to vote on the bill later this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Oil was the other tentpole for investors today, up $1.38 to a record close of $78.21. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Almost 3 months to the day that the news broke, Rupert Murdoch seems to have won control of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. There are still some boardroom formalities to go through, but all signs are that enough members of the Bancroft family have decided to take Mr. Murdoch up on his offer of $60 a share. Yesterday, about this time, the outcome was in some doubt. Overnight, though, there was a twist. Bancrofts who were against the sale, who had said they were uncomfortable with Rupert Murdoch, changed their minds once they realized they'd be on the hook for lawyers and bankers' fees if the deal failed. Aline Van Dyne's been covering developments today for the Financial Times. And Ms. Van Dyne, was it just that that changed people's minds, that they're getting their bills paid?
Well, certainly there were a group of members of the Bancroft family who seemed to be holding out for slightly better terms than those that Rupert Murdoch had offered. He'd offered $60 a share. Some family members wanted to sell but were hoping for a much higher price. And in the end, it seems like they've settled for a higher price, but in the form of having their legal and advisory fees paid.
We've been going through the machinations on this deal now for almost 3 months, since May the 1st, when news of the bid broke. Was it really a fait accompli back on May the 1st or 2nd when the Bancroft family didn't firmly close the door and stock price zoomed?
Well, certainly Rupert Murdoch has been trying to think of ways that he can buy the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones for at least a decade. And it seemed as if he spotted an opportunity. But there's been a lot of family turmoil, and there continues to be. In the end, though, it's often hard to refuse a large amount of money. And I think there's been historically very few cases where families have managed to hold out in the face of a generous offer for the assets that they've inherited.
What do you make of the fact, just watching the market today, that Dow Jones shares are still not back to the $60 that Rupert Murdoch offered 3 months ago?
The shares are certainly a lot closer to 60 now than they have been. In fact, yesterday they traded below $50, which seems astonishing just a day before the result of a deal was in. And I think it highlights the uncertainty and it highlights the divisions.
Any doubt at all that this deal will close and that'll happen?
Well, I guess you never know until it's finally signed and sealed, but it seems very unlikely that this will slip away from Mr. Murdoch this time.
Was this entire protracted episode just an instance of Rupert Murdoch realizing the value of financial information in the digital age and the Bancroft family realizing it but a decade or two too late?
Yes, the Bancroft family has not been a very hands-on newspaper-owning family. Some of the other U.S. newspaper-owning families are much more involved in their businesses. So, yes, some of the family members themselves say that they should have been more active in the last 25 years or so to have prevented this. And indeed, Warren Buffett has criticized the family, saying that they blew it and arguing that potentially Dow Jones could have been worth $50 billion today instead of the $5 billion that Rupert Murdoch's paying for it.
We shall never know. Aline Van Dyne at the Financial Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good things come in small packages, the saying goes, and scientists are certainly counting on it. Nanotechnology has been used in hundreds of consumer products, everything from cosmetics to clothing. Some groups have called for tougher oversight and proof of the safety of nanotechnology, but last week the FDA declined to require additional regulations for products made with nanotech. Commentator and chemical engineer Bill Hammack offers some advice.
A few years ago, Prince Charles suggested nanotechnology could be a disaster like thalidomide, the 1960s drug that caused grotesque birth defects. Now, many of my engineering colleagues like to brush off these comments as alarmists, but thalidomide did show the perils of modern technology, which does have its dangers. But the nanotech community isn't listening yet. You see, right now, nano is, in the words of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, technologically sweet. That's when scientists are so enamored of invention, they figure they'll argue about what to do about the implications later once a product exists. Engineers and scientists find nothing sweeter than nano. The U.S. government is pouring more than $3.5 billion into research right now. My colleagues dream of the most exotic things: toothpaste filled with nanoparticles that repair damaged teeth, or pills that are really tiny pacemakers. But the revolutionary aspect can blind a researcher as to how these products will fit into our world. Just look at nanotech's unanswered questions. Is it a chemically toxic substance or an ultrafine particle like dust, forest fire smoke, or volcanic ash? Can you even patent a nanomachine? Does a nano-sized motor qualify as a new invention? In the past, a simple change in size hasn't been patentable unless some novelty comes from the miniaturization. Right now, the government should be investing a sizable chunk of those billions into scientific, engineering, and legal studies that can answer all these questions and more. Otherwise, just like with the biotech industry, fear may take over and possibly cripple the nascent industry. But if we don't do it right, you can be sure that the public will bite back at those tiny machines big time.
Bill Hammack is a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Look for that link that says contact. You know, there's fancy science like nanotechnology that Bill Hammack was just telling us about. And then there are the simpler things in life, like whiling away a summer Saturday working in your garden. Odds are that means you use some kind of fertilizer, and odds are that that fertilizer's from Miracle-Gro. Scotts, which owns Miracle-Gro, is a $3 billion behemoth with more than half of the market, which leaves little room for an organic plant food maker with what you might call a creative new product. Alex Goldmark has that story.
Old soda bottles, leftover beer, and worm poop. That may sound like the aftermath of a weird agricultural college party to you and me, but to 25-year-old CEO Tom Zaki, it's a business plan. In 2001, he dropped out of Princeton to start TerraCycle, an organic plant food company. It turns organic garbage into a consumer product.
Yeah, the type of garbage we take is, for example, like the brewery waste from Anheuser-Busch, or different types of manures, or coffee grounds, eggshells, anything that is organic that isn't usable.
Shovel that into giant worm-filled dirt boxes connected to conveyor belts and sifters in what they call a worm gin, and, quote, let the worms do their thing.
We then take the solid worm poop and liquefy it into a liquid worm poop, which is very similar to a liquid organic fertilizer. Then that is packaged in literally used soda bottles, like old Coke and Pepsi bottles. A trigger sprayer is put on it, and that becomes TerraCycle plant food.
But Zaki's business isn't all about eco-thrift. It's also about making a quality product. TerraCycle claims its organic plant food is as good or better than the leading chemical fertilizer. Tough talk for a little guy when it's obvious the company means it's better than Miracle-Gro. Long story short, TerraCycle got sued.
We're not saying let's see the formula, let's see the secret formulation of extracting worm poop. We're saying let's see the proof.
That's Jim King. He's vice president of corporate communications at Scotts Miracle-Gro. He's suing to see TerraCycle's plant food performance study, but TerraCycle's refusing for now. Scotts isn't leaving it at that. It's also claiming consumers might confuse TerraCycle with Miracle-Gro because of the way it's packaged.
Over the years, we have found ourselves in a situation similar to this many times where we've had to go to competitors and say, your trade dress is far too close to ours. We want you to make changes to your packaging, or we'll have to find another solution.
Both products are packaged in green and yellow. Miracle-Gro has trademarked those colors in certain proportions. But Columbia University law professor Scott Hemphill says the confusion claim is weak. He says TerraCycle's motley mix of used soda bottles distinguishes it from Miracle-Gro, and even the color argument could be difficult to defend.
The problem here is that green and yellow are pretty common. And moreover, that green and yellow, the colors that they have in mind, invoke naturally enough grass and sun. That's bad news for Scotts, since it is tantamount to claiming a monopoly in the use of red and green in Christmas packaging.
Hemphill says big companies often use this kind of lawsuit to protect their brands and market share. That's not just bad news for the up-and-comers, it's bad news for consumers too, as it can stifle competition, he says. CEO Tom Zaki says he had to spend 30% of his earnings in legal fees this month, and if he slapped with another lawsuit, it could drive him out of business. So he might not want to hear this comment from Professor Hemphill.
The most famous example of trade dress in the country is probably Coca-Cola's curvy bottle. These curvy bottles are being reused and refilled with fertilizer. So I mean, one wonders whether, even if Miracle-Gro doesn't have a claim, Coca-Cola might.
And TerraCycle hasn't even turned a profit yet. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Coming up, sizing up our footprint on the world.
To get back to where we were before we started tinkering with the atmosphere, think 100,000 years.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials carved off 146 points today, 1.1% to end at 13,211. The Nasdaq erased 37 points, 1.4% to finish at 2546. The S&P 500 chipped away 18 points, 1.25% to wind up at 1455. We told you stock in the big mortgage provider American Home Mortgage tanked 90%. Just for the record, that means a share that was worth more than 10 bucks before the opening bell now goes for a dollar and a bit. Back in December, those shares were trading as high as $36. And change. MGIC Investment Corporation and Radiant Group also plummeted 15 and 16% respectively. The two home loan insurers have combined stakes of more than $1 billion in a subprime mortgage company. Not a good place to be these days. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Detroit, automakers report sales figures for the month of July. A House committee convenes a hearing on military recruiting and retention. And happy birthday to MTV. At the time of its premiere on August 1st, 1981, it was an all-music channel. Today, we can count on MTV to keep us up to speed on broader pop perspectives with scripted dramas and reality programming. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Department of Health and Human Services has a man in China today. He's leading a team negotiating a deal on food and drug safety. The U.S. government wants an agreement in place by December, a deadline that's been driven in part by congressional hearings into potentially unsafe Chinese imports. One of the first questions people who've been injured in cases like that usually ask is, who do I sue? The answer is not the Chinese manufacturer. American product liability lawyers are choosing targets a bit closer to home. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us why.
The prime targets for lawyers here are the American distributors of Chinese goods. Product liability lawyer Bill Ruskin in New York says that's legitimate under personal injury law.
If you are anywhere in the stream of distribution, you are potentially liable for selling a defective product, although you may have had no knowledge that the product you sold contained a harmful substance or was otherwise defective.
But Ruskin says it's also just a matter of where the money is.
By going after the distributor, you can find a deep pocket in the United States that has assets and can pay a judgment.
That eliminates jurisdiction and collection problems. It also cuts out the politics. Michael Hausfeld's Washington law firm is looking into filing some drug and pet food suits. He says there are also logistical problems with going after a Chinese company. That's because products often move from cell to cell along a chain of firms before they're assembled and sold.
If you're four or five cells removed in a chain of sale or distribution, you're only going to know the person that you directly deal with and not the person whom that person directly deals with.
Hausfeld says that's what happened in some cases where pet food was contaminated. Manufacturers in the U.S. literally had no idea where the ingredients originated. But ignorance is no excuse. People who bought Chinese-made car tires are at the heart of one prominent case. The government and a private lawyer are going after New Jersey-based Foreign Tire Sales, which distributed the tires nationally. FTS is a small company, just 13 employees. But it says one of them was a full-time engineer who drew up specifications for imported tires to meet U.S. standards. An accident on some of those tires claimed two lives. Victims' families sued. And FTS says it learned the tires were missing a component they'd ordered called a gum strip. It holds tire treads together. Company executives wouldn't speak with us. They're in sensitive negotiations right now. But here are excerpts read by one of our staff members from public statements the company made before going silent.
FTS was being sold tires that did not meet our own standards and posed a safety hazard. These tires were manufactured without a gum strip or with an insufficient gum strip between the belts or other construction. Such construction is susceptible to belt and/or tread separations.
FTS doesn't deny that it's required by law to take responsibility. The Chinese manufacturer, on the other hand, still denies its tires are defective. Washington attorney Michael Hausfeld says the whole mess illustrates a shortcoming of globalized production and distribution chains. He says uniform global quality standards for goods are a must, and people on the importing end are starting to realize that.
I think any distributor or manufacturer or integrator is on notice that they need to do something more than just accept the good without any further confirmation as to the source of the quality of the ingredient or component.
Liability lawyer Bill Ruskin says the recent scandals will force some changes, and he says they'll show up on both ends of the import-export chain.
I think you're going to see some winnowing in China. You're going to see a lot of the smaller mom-and-pop exporters going out of business. In this country, only larger distributors that have the assets to assure retailers that they'll be financially responsible for any losses will be taking the preeminent position in the marketplace.
Ruskin says one way globalization can make a positive difference here is through shareholder activism. Foreign investment has driven much of the Chinese manufacturing boom. He says American and European investors need to step up to the plate now and start policing the Chinese companies they invest in. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Here's one from the Marketplace desk of What If. What if people just disappeared, all six-something billion of us, gone, tomorrow? What happens to everything we've left behind? It's a thought experiment that Alan Weisman indulges in his new book, The World Without Us. Mr. Weisman, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Guy.
Let's pick up with the instant that the human race disappears from this planet, and then play out for me the consequences. Do years and decades and centuries of human economic development and society start being overcome immediately within hours or days, or are we talking a matter of geologic time here?
Almost instantly, because things are already going on. Anybody who's a homeowner, and I have a chapter in here about how your own home would be dismantled by nature rather efficiently if you weren't there maintaining it. It turns out that the same forces that would tear apart a house would tear apart New York, for instance. I descended into the subways with engineers who showed me that if it wasn't for the fact that they were pumping groundwater away constantly with about 800 pumps, the subway tunnels would flood. Then the columns that hold up the streets would start to corrode, and within 15, 20 years, some of them would start to collapse. Streets would start caving in. Lexington Avenue would start being a river again.
Are we spending money now sort of in spite of ourselves trying to maintain our presence on this planet? Have we made, in our economic developments over the past century or so, life harder for ourselves in terms of maintaining our presence?
I think we have in some ways. Let's think about agriculture. We have developed crops that produce much more per acre, but the cost of that has been chemical inputs that we've all heard an awful lot about that may be backfiring on us. That stuff's going to stay in the soil for a long time. And we now make our food travel, or let our food travel. And that's really problematic for two reasons. One, the incredible amount of energy expenditure. And the other is a lot of the ecosystem that is being scraped away in places so we can grow export crops.
Other than the obvious thing, nuclear waste, is there something we've created that will just never go away?
Plastics, an element, or I would say material, that showed up in our ecosystem on a large scale just after World War II. There's nothing out there right now that knows how to biodegrade it.
But we're told all the time that we've got biodegradable shopping bags now and all that stuff?
There are some biodegradable shopping bags, and I'm told that there's some that are actually, they're made out of organic polymers that will dissolve, but the majority of them, and I talked to scientists who have tested them, found out that they really have matrices made out of materials that will make them sort of shred into little particles, and they'll kind of vanish, but the particles of plastic continues to exist.
If humanity went away tomorrow, how long would it take for carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere to get back to pre-human levels of 10, 15, 20,000 years ago?
Well, carbon dioxide has, the amount of it in the atmosphere has varied in the past, depending on what was going on geologically. Now, that said, there are three ways that carbon get absorbed, and the ocean is one of the most significant. The ocean turns over every 1,000 years. So in the first 1,000 years, though the ocean couldn't get it all, it would get a good percentage, perhaps up to 80% of the carbon that we have overloaded into the atmosphere. And in the first few centuries, a lot of that would go. But to get back to where we were before we started tinkering with the atmosphere, think 100,000 years.
The book by Alan Weisman is called The World Without Us. Mr. Weisman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke may have his finger on the pulse of the U.S. economy, but he doesn't exactly dive into the fray himself. The Fed released his financial disclosure forms today. The boss plays it safe with a no-frills collection of U.S. treasuries, mutual funds, and some annuities. No individual stocks or bonds. He's got a couple of annuities valued at up to $1 million apiece. His only liability was a 10-year student loan taken out last year for his kids. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plummeted 146 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 37 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 off 18 points. That is 1.25% there. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, chronicling the seamy side of Wall Street.
So you've got characters who are in the grips of their own worst impulses, who are acting against their own best interests, who often know that they're doing those things and yet are compelled to do it anyway.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.